All right. Ready, Frank?
Sure am.
Excellent. Okay, we'll start here in 3, 2, 1. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America. My guest today is accomplished author and reporter Frank Miniter. His latest book is The Future of the Gun. And Frank, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
We'll certainly be talking about the future of the gun in terms of technology and its impact on our country in just a little bit, but the book also spends quite a bit of time on explaining how, both in our past and our present, guns have played a much larger role in shaping our society than a lot of people probably realize, and that begins with the idea of an armed citizenry actually being interested in technological advances in weapons, and that benefits our law enforcement and military as well. Explain that kind of symbiosis that's really important for everyone.
Yeah, it's an important connection to freedom, to a real American freedom that I think has become very politically incorrect, and a lot of people just really don't understand. For example, right at the beginning of our American Revolution, at the battles of Lexington and Concord, the Americans had rifles that were made by independent rifle makers, mostly in New England, whereas the British had Brown Besses, a smooth-bore firearm, which wasn't nearly as accurate as what the colonialists had. Colonialists could shoot up to 300 yards away using a rifled bullet. Rifle barrel shooting a bullet, whereas the British were just lobbing a big round through that smooth bore. It's like the difference between a knuckleball and a fastball. The rifle barrel, of course, is just much more accurate. So right there, they started off on the right footing, and that connection between freedom and American citizens and our private arms makers and the military and our police has always been a real connection. In fact, most of the firearms used over time and today were first used and made for civilians before it went to the military. And in fact, the semi-automatic firearm, which has so much controversy around it today, as it's called an assault weapon and so on, and the AR-15 and those kind of platforms, was first made for the civilian market by a private company and sold as the AR-15 and actually made the market through Colt. At the same time, it came to the military, and the military picked it up and, of course, became the iconic gun of the Vietnam War. This has always been a connection between civilians and the military, and breaking that connection, a lot of special forces and other people have told me, would just actually harm our ability to still fight for freedom around the world.
Frank, you have a lot of very interesting anecdotes. There's a lot of firsthand history from curators of different museums and so forth in the book. You also do a ride-along with a sheriff in Maryland, around Salisbury, Maryland, and he kind of puts a very different spin on the debate over whether only law enforcement should have guns in this country. He says absolutely not. Explain why an armed citizenry is something that law enforcement actually is very much in favor of.
Yeah, that sheriff, Mike Lewis, he actually started the first drug interdiction unit in Baltimore over 30 years ago and was responsible for running that unit and still trains that unit. Now, of course, he's a sheriff. And I asked him, in all those years and all the bad guys you've arrested, have you ever arrested a good guy with a gun, who used that gun illegally? And he thought about it a minute. He said, you know, actually, I haven't. Every single time I've arrested somebody that's been prosecuted and found guilty, they always had that gun illegally. That's an amazing statistic. When you look at that nationally, it's rare to find somebody who has a concealed carry permit, for example, an armed citizen, using that gun in an illegal way. In fact, there are some studies that show they actually use them less often in crimes than police officers do. So it's, you know, those are small samples, so it's hard to say that exactly, but that's how really safe they are. But Sheriff Lewis showed me that dichotomy between the illegal gun culture and the legal gun culture in a very graphic way.
You also talk in the book about how many different sheriffs in New York State are simply refusing to enforce different parts of the SAFE Act. That was the major gun control legislation passed in the wake of the Sandy Hook shootings. We've heard the same thing about certain sheriffs out in Colorado in the wake of those gun control laws as well. Talk about that to some extent and how that's framing the debate.
Yeah, a majority of sheriffs in New York, Colorado, and in Maryland are all opposed to those new laws that have been passed that are gun bans on the average citizen who just wants to own firearms. Those gun bans won't stop crimes. I mean, rifles are used in less than 3% of murders as it is, and the armed citizen just isn't using those guns that way. It's the unlawful person, the criminal who's getting those through very different means, and I go into that in the book, who's using those in that criminal way. So the only way to really fight the crime is to go after the bad guys, not the guns. Too often the gun control crowd wants to go after the guns. They see all guns as bad. Actually, that doesn't work. What works is going after the bad guys. And that's what those sheriffs believe. Those sheriffs are elected. They're listening to their constituents, and they're speaking from that basis.
We're talking with Frank Miniter. The book is The Future of the Gun. And Frank, another interesting topic you bring up in the book is that Democrats largely are the ones that push gun control legislation. And for the most part, they have pretty willing allies in the mainstream media. Yet time after time, they don't win the individual battles, which frustrates them. And they always say the NRA essentially holds sway over various members of the House and Senate. You say to some extent that's true, but they're missing the large part of the story. Why does the pro-gun side seemingly always win, at least on the national level?
Yeah, I don't think that's actually true at all. That's the insinuation you get from mainstream media, that the NRA somehow has something on some congressmen that makes them vote a certain way. Well, I went with some of the NRA's lobbyists and actually went with them on the Hill doing what they do and got behind the scenes with them. And over again, what I found out is they only have sway because they have about 5 million NRA members. And there's about 100 million people in the United States of America that own a firearm and understand it is a practical right. And many of them vote that issue on those means. So congressmen listen when you walk in with that size of a constituency. That's the whole power and base of the NRA. It's the American people. It's not some other dark, mysterious thing.
Let's talk about the media a little bit more, because you have some fascinating conversations in here. One with Stephen Hunter, longtime movie reviewer, actually with the Washington Post, who's had a conversion on the Second Amendment, and also one of the original founders of CNN, who certainly had a change of heart on the issue as well. Talk about the idea of groupthink. They point out that people aren't told how to report on this, but there is a lot of pressure about how to approach the issue. Explain that.
Yeah, Stephen Hunter put that very well. And of course, he's a well-known novelist and a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Post, who's now retired from the Post. But while he was there, he in the 80s is when he really started to convert to guns. And he realized, wait a second, they don't cause crimes. The bad people do. And he kind of liked guns and shooting them and got into that and just got to know, just through his own investigation, that whole area of America. And he started to actually convert young reporters. He would say, look, come to me when you're going to report on a gun issue, and I'll give you some contacts. I'll help you. I'll show you. I'll take you shooting so you'll actually have an understanding of what you're writing about. And he said over time, the Washington Post, while he was there, went from really anti-gun to at least moderately anti-gun. That's the way he put it. And I asked him, well, wait a second. Well, why do they think this way? What do we do? And he said, there's a group think, especially with young reporters. They believe in consensus. They believe in conformity. And stepping outside of that conformity, that puts an individual by themselves. And that actually would take them out of that pack. And they wouldn't get the promotions and so on in the newsroom. And when you think about it, a gun owner, possibly woman or man, standing up for themselves possibly, in their home against a bad guy coming through a window after they call 911 or waiting for a cop to get there. But that person with that gun, that's a real individual standing out on a limb, protecting their life and their family. That sort of individualism is hard for a consensus reporter who's used to conformity and going along with the group's values to stomach. He said only the most brave can actually look at that and understand it.
Frank, as the title suggests, you also spend a lot of time in this book talking about the future of the gun, literally. You talk about the evolution of the pistol and semi-automatic weapons and rifles and that sort of thing. You also kind of take a look into the future with different ways that triggers are being manufactured these days, being able to tag your targets through technology, 3D printing and that sort of thing. So where do you think it's headed, and what's going to be that larger impact on our society, assuming we head in those directions?
Yeah, and it is, especially on the high end of guns. Right now, a lot of young engineers are looking at firearms and saying, wait a second, this is mostly a 19th century and early 20th century invention of steel cut on lathes, combined with wood, and then later with polymer. But I can take all these other technologies with a program that must use SolidWorks. It's a CAD programmer that can build stuff on screen. And they can take all these other technologies, sort of infuse them and make these guns smarter, more ergonomic, and just better. So over the last few decades, since the Glock revolution, we've seen guns that can fit everyone's hand. You can find grips and so on that'll fit your hand based on your caliber of choices. And they're more ergonomic. The safety is in better positions. Guns have just gotten safer and safer because of this. And now we're starting to see electronics embedded into guns. And the smart gun controversy is out there. And that's a piece of that whole thing where a gun can actually recognize a user and then not work for someone who's not authorized through that gun to use it. That's very controversial because the anti-gun movement wants to make that mandatory. And by making it mandatory, they make every gun now available illegal, because there's only two guns that are now smart guns coming to market. And that technology really has to be vetted and find its place in the marketplace and find those niches to fill them. But I don't like to get lost in that spot, because that's only a small piece of the future of the gun. It's really that integration of the electronics into the trigger systems through the optic systems that really is the future of the gun.
And do you think that'll be the next battleground, what you mentioned in terms of the political side of this over mandatory smart guns, or where do you think the next battleground is going to be?
That is the battleground right now. The anti-gun groups want it made mandatory. They see it as a great way to ban a lot of guns and then to control them. In fact, Attorney General Eric Holder had a conversation on this with one of the makers of one of the smart guns, Bill Gentry of Kodiak Arms. He makes the IntelliGun out of Salt Lake, Utah. He uses a biometric scanner on the grip of a 1911 pistol to recognize you. He had a conversation with him, and Holder was going on about possibly using the government being an authorized in this kind of control. And Bill Gentry said, wait a second, Mr. Holder, if you try to mandate my technology, I will burn it down. That's the level that this is separating between gun owners and those who understand this topic and some on the government side who see this as an effort to control it.
Frank, fascinating stuff, and I'm sure you'll be right in the thick of the debate as it continues on this and other fronts. Thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
And thanks for having me.
Frank Miniter is an accomplished reporter and author. His latest book is The Future of the Gun. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.